From CAFE, welcome to CAFE Insider. I'm Preet Bharara.
And I'm Ann Milgram.
Hey, Ann, it's been quite a week.
It feels a lot longer, Preet.
People I keep seeing on social media talk about the 13th month of 2020, and that's kind of what it feels like.
It does. It does. It feels also like years have passed since last Wednesday.
Well, we recorded a special episode on the day of what I think is appropriately called an insurrection. And since that time, you know, we were reacting in the moment that evening. Lots of other things have happened. We've learned about deaths. Capitol Police Officer Brian Sicknick died of wounds. Apparently, he suffered at the hands of the rioters. Another Capitol Police Officer apparently has died by suicide. I don't remember at the time if we knew about the three other folks who passed away, and one woman was shot trying to enter the House floor. So there's been a lot of death. We've also now seen videos that are incredibly disturbing of how close the rioters got to Speaker Pelosi's office. In fact, got into her office, but she was in a secure location. And the thing that I can't get over, and I, you know, you and I haven't spoken since Wednesday directly, is all these people chanting, "Hang Mike Pence."
Yes.
Hang the Vice President of the United States. Why? In part because he was demonized by Donald Trump for not doing the thing that is completely unlawful and unconstitutional to do, which is to hand the presidency and the election over to the person who lost. And the fact that Donald Trump, we're recording this on Tuesday morning, January 12th, Donald Trump didn't even bother to call Mike Pence until yesterday, tells you everything you need to know, if you didn't already know it, about Donald Trump.
Yeah, I mean, I think we recorded very quickly. And what has become really clear, I think, to me over almost the past week is first the extent of the danger that existed and just how incredibly close the rioters, you know, these individuals, the extremists, we'll talk about domestic terrorism in a minute, that this mob came to this situation being far worse, to kidnapping elected officials, to potentially murdering elected officials. I mean, you see the pictures, and we didn't see these pictures on Wednesday. I didn't see them till Thursday. But, you know, individuals walking around with flex cuffs, which are used to basically handcuff people, wearing militia gear, the number of weapons, the assault weapons, the Molotov cocktails that have since been found. I mean, the extent of danger and violence and weapons that were present on Wednesday, I think, and just how close this situation came to being even more of a catastrophe and a disaster than it already is. So the depth of this, the danger of this. Also, I understood that there had been online media posts, but having had the past week to sort of review them and reflect them, and to now see that there were hashtags, storm the Capitol, that there were repeated sort of conversations about finding Pence, stopping the vote, killing the House Speaker, Nancy Pelosi. And a lot of this was sort of, while not, you know, the president himself was not directly involved in the online chatter, there was a distinct effort by the president and by his followers and his team to brand the Stop the Steal campaign, to basically be out there undercutting the results of a fair and free election, and to basically be encouraging their supporters to overturn and to stop Congress from certifying the vote. And so I think the severity and seriousness of it, I felt it, you know, I think we both felt it Wednesday night, but it's so important that everyone, that we all be on the same page with this conversation about, you know, Fiona Hill has now called it an attempted self-coup by the president of the United States. And I didn't grasp all of it, you know, in those sort of moments as it was unfolding.
I don't think we still are. I think there's more to uncover. And the other crazy things that you have now seen, that we have now seen, is that there appear to have been Capitol Police officers who were complicit. There were some who were heroes, and we've seen those videos, who averted what potentially could have been. I don't think this is an overstatement, given what we saw and given how the timing worked out. I think it could have been a massacre.
I agree.
And there were involved, you know, I think some people like to think, well, it was a bunch of rubes who descended on the Capitol who didn't know anything. There were people who looked like they were law enforcement officers from around the country who were involved. Elected officials. There's an elected representative from West Virginia who proudly announced himself as having entered the Capitol. He has since resigned. So there are a lot of people who knew better and have taken oaths to uphold the Constitution and to uphold what we used to know as the rule of law and law and order, who were part of this uprising against democracy in this country. So I can't tell you the number of people who have said to me some version of, I'm shook. And there are other folks who say, well, this is not surprising at all. I think it's a combination of two things.
I think it's a combination of not being surprised by Donald Trump, but I'm shaken by a number of things. One is, you know, none of this is possible without the enablers, and those include the U.S. senators and members of the House of Representatives who were objecting to the vote. But it also includes a lot of the Make America Great folks, again, who became militant, who became all about Trump and not about the United States. And look, it almost goes without saying that real patriots support the United States Constitution, and they don't try to overthrow the government. And there was a angry, armed, militant mob that engaged not only in a riot, but in acts of insurrection against the United States government. And, you know, they cloaked themselves in MAGA hats and Trump banners. And the question is, I think, you know, there may be people who join that movement for all different reasons, but I think we have to be very clear in saying that these were not rubes. These were people who went there with an intentional political goal of overturning a free and fair election. And that is insurrection. To have a peaceful protest is not, but to forcefully enter the Capitol armed in Kevlar with bear spray. And not everyone had those things, but, you know, there are a lot of folks that
a lot did.
And a lot are associated with, you know, the three percenters, right-wing extremist group. There's a lot of anti-Semitic groups who were part of it with the, you know,
they're wearing Camp Auschwitz t-shirts.
Yes. And I think we have to be really clear about what this movement has become. And it's like, I was sort of thinking about this the other night, like how to make folks understand that, yes, some people may have gone there just thinking, the election was fraudulent, I need to be heard. And then all of a sudden they're storming the Capitol and walking into the Capitol. People need to understand, like, you know, you are judged by the company you keep and by the decisions you make in that moment. And
yeah,
so
that's 100% true.
You know, and we have to all, I think, be real about the harm that is done by each and every single one of those individuals who left the Capitol Mall and entered the United States Capitol.
Do you know how we know that these were un-American, unpatriotic people? The symbol to me, and again, not everyone, but there were people who were taking down the American flag, our flag, and putting up a Trump flag, which shows loyalty to a single person who had lost the election rather than the country and what our flag represents. So, you know, we talk about anger. It's maybe a good segue to talk about the other side of the coin. There is deep, visceral anger on the part of many people, and I mean, not just the populace, not just you and me and other people we know, the people in Congress who were basically at risk of physical harm, potentially losing their lives. And I think it's lost on Donald Trump and some others how deep-seated the anger is among Republicans as well.
This was kind of like a hostage situation, right? And it wasn't, because no one was actually taken hostage, but the members of Congress were basically taken to secured rooms. There were people trying to batter down rioters, insurrectionists trying to batter down those doors. And I think looking at it on the other side of this now, knowing that they weren't harmed, maybe doesn't let you fully capture the fact that at the moment in time that those members of Congress were sitting in those rooms listening to people screaming outside, breaking glass and trying to break down doors to get in, they had no idea what was going to happen. And so that level of fear.
They didn't know if they were armed and
exactly,
to what degree.
Exactly. And that level of trauma, I think we shouldn't underappreciate how difficult this was
deal.
For people. Yeah.
No, and the 60 Minutes had a special with Nancy Pelosi, and she showed where her staff was carrying under a table in one of her offices for 2 hours while people are trying to break the door down. No, it's terrifying. It'd be terrifying for anybody, but it's the seat of government. It's, you know, I think we should segue to what the consequences should be for Donald Trump and others. You see this extraordinary move to try to invoke the 25th Amendment or impeach. And the way I think about it before we get into the legality of it is, here you have the head of one branch of government, Donald Trump, basically urging and inciting a mob to go do violence to a co-equal branch of government. It's as simple as that. And so, you know, whether or not there's a legal statute, criminal statute that has been violated and a case can be brought by the Department of Justice at some point, whatever, and we'll talk about that. This is basically a crisis of the Constitution between branches of government. And that, I think, is a preliminary matter, that it is more than appropriate for Congress to take action based on its obligations and duties and powers not just some, you know, law enforcement official like the Attorney General of DC or, you know, some other law enforcement outfit. It has to be resolved in some ways as a political matter. And so one of the, look, there's this thing in the Constitution we've been talking about for 3 or 4 years called the 25th Amendment. And I don't think we have to spend a lot of time on it because I don't think it's going to happen. But it's kind of startling how much the 25th Amendment has gotten into people's vocabulary and dialogue just in the last 6 days. And not as a lark, not in a lark, but as a sort of serious consideration. We've had multiple members of the cabinet resign. Each time that happens, someone says, well, can an acting member of the cabinet vote on the removal of the president? And just maybe we should outline quickly what the 25th Amendment provides.
Before we get there, just quickly, I just want to sort of say to your points three things. The first is that I think we should be really focused on what you talk about with the co-equal branches, the president trying to overrun the will of Congress. It's almost more dire than that because this is a test of the United States Constitution. And this is the president saying that he is above the law, that he does not have to adhere to the U.S. Constitution. And I think it has to be seen as starkly as that. The other piece about what you said about criminal prosecution versus politics is that prosecutions need to be brought. The individuals who incited this riot, the individuals who engaged in insurrection in the Capitol, they need to be held accountable. And we talked about that a little bit last week. That is not enough. And criminal prosecutions are not the full answer here. You have a president who is very dangerous to the health, safety of Americans and to the future of our democracy and the republic. You also have a situation in which a number of members of Congress basically engaged in conduct that was deeply, deeply just undercut the Constitution and our democracy. And so the question is, how do you account for, and you also have significant law enforcement failures. So the questions of how you
account,
there's a lot of stuff. And criminal prosecutions won't answer that. And frankly, I think we should talk a little bit down the road about just the lack of any federal briefings on this, the lack of information coming out. A lot of people are hiding and trying to not be held accountable. And so that kind of stuff, you're not going to get to a criminal prosecution, but you need to get answers. So
yeah, I think there's a whole panoply of things, failures, omissions, deliberate misconduct. But because the president leaves office in 8 days, the question of whether he leaves office before or he faces some punishment as an initial matter is something we should, you know, unpack a little bit. So the 25th Amendment was amendment passed not that long, as you pointed out, just a little bit before I was born, to put in place a line of succession. And Section 4 of the 25th Amendment is a provision in which there is the possibility of removing a president if that president becomes incapacitated in some way. And I think generally, it's been thought of as a provision that applies when there is some physical or mental handicap, you know, some medical condition. Do you find it interesting that people are talking about the president's behavior here as something that should trigger the 25th Amendment? I should also point out that, you know, there's only 8 days left. The 25th Amendment calls for a majority vote led by the Vice President of the United States of the cabinet to write a letter to Congress to say the president is not fit to proceed in his job. Then the president and his allies can send a responsive letter, and then there's a 21-day period that is discussed in that amendment. So, you know, all of that, even if everyone was on board, is a difficult thing to accomplish in the next 8 days. But I think it's been used as sort of a point to make clear how serious this is. And the fact that some cabinet officials seem to have been talking about it reportedly just underlines the seriousness of it. But I don't think it's a thing that can or will happen.
Well, so first of all, it's never been invoked. And I think it was initially passed after it was passed in 1967, thinking about the assassination of JFK and other instances in which, you know, presidents could be incapacitated. There's another subsection that's been used by prior presidents who are undergoing surgery where they'll be under anesthesia and so they won't be able to govern. So it was basically meant to handle situations where the president isn't fully capacitated and also mentally, I would argue, able to handle the jobs of the presidency. But we don't know that. Like, the extent of it hasn't been tested. And so I would argue here that it is a very reasonable thing the president's behavior, even during the riots, he was still calling members of the United States Senate, asking them to oppose certification of the electoral vote. It's reported that he was essentially excited by watching the riots, that he didn't understand why others were deeply concerned who were around him. And so there's a fair argument that the president is what George Conway, who's been on Stay Tuned before, has said, that he's just a narcissist and has severe inability to see anything outside of his own self. And so I think there's a powerful argument. I also think a lot of people talked about it for the very simple reason that in that moment, the first question was, how do you get the president's fingers off the nuclear codes? And how do you stop this? And how do you stop it from happening next week? Because there have been online and other reports about the same people who were at the Capitol last Wednesday, going back to the United States Capitol and to the State House Capitols on January 17th, and going back to Washington, D.C. on the 20th. And so there is this real sense of imminent potential harm. And I think that's why it came out, because the vice president gets a majority of the cabinet. They vote. You're right. It goes back and forth. But they could have taken him out of functioning as the president through the end of his term. It's not going to happen, both because, mostly, I think, because Mike Pence isn't there.
Even though there were people who were saying, hang Mike Pence. And to those people, Donald Trump said, I love you.
Right. And I'm surprised Mike Pence wasn't there. It sounds to me from the public reporting that he flirted with it and that a number of cabinet members called him. It was also reported that, and again, we don't know how accurate this is, but it was a credible news media publication reported that Betsy DeVos resigned after learning that Pence would not invoke the 25th Amendment. So basically feeling that, okay, I'll stay if Pence is going to step up and we're going to do this. If we're not, I can't be a part of this. And so, but I do think, look, I think it made sense from the perspective that it doesn't have to go through Congress. You don't need a supermajority vote to get something done. It would have been quick. It would have accomplished in the short term getting Trump out of office during this very dangerous next 8 days. And so I see the appeal, but...
But it also makes a point. So Nancy Pelosi, Speaker of the House, is going to take, I think they've taken some of these votes already. There have to be votes on whether or not there's a resolution in favor of invoking the 25th Amendment. And so part of this is a political...
To put people on record.
Approach.
Yes.
Yeah. Are you with democracy? Or are you against democracy? And the other thing I'll say is, I have some people on social media and otherwise asking the question, like, why is it so hard? Why is it so hard? And I'll say something maybe is not popular in this particular moment. It should be very, very, very hard to remove a president of the United States.
Who's democratically elected.
Who's exactly. Democratically elected. I mean, yep. You don't want it in trying to help protect the country in these final days of the Trump presidency. We do need to sometimes pause for a moment and make sure that we're not doing something as dire as it is that will so simplify and ease the removal of a president that that's done, willy-nilly in a future presidency.
That's right, because some people would do it
party,
for good
yeah,
reasons and others wouldn't.
You can imagine, you can imagine a Democratic president in the future who is unpopular at a moment when Republicans have, significant majorities in the House and Senate. Should they be able to very simply and easily, by voting where there's no mental incapacity and not this kind of erratic behavior, remove a democratically elected president? I think it applies here, but we just need to be careful not to wish for something that's too simple, because that's a dangerous precedent going forward as well.
Also, there was a benefit to having this conversation last week, and that benefit is that it's very clear that members of the president's staff and reportedly also the White House counsel, a number of individuals were able to convince the president that this was imminent and that it could happen, that he could actually be removed from office under the 25th Amendment. He did make a statement on Thursday essentially conceding the election for the first time. He's now stepped back a bit from it.
Very reluctantly.
He did look a little like he was very uncomfortable, like he'd been forced to write the apology note in school. But he did it. And he also talked about, he condemned the individuals who entered the Capitol. Now, again, whether that holds or whether he tries to pardon all those individuals, I think is still to be seen. And we'll talk about that. But it's still in the moment. At a really critical time, it did have an impact on the president's conduct.
So the president, to the extent he likes to do unprecedented things and have unprecedented achievements, one is going to be, he will be the first president in the history of the United States to be impeached twice. And we have the latest, I'm looking at the latest draft of an article of impeachment, one article, upon which I think the House will vote in the next day. And we should talk about that. And then we should talk about whether or not, you know, there's some criminal case to be made against Donald Trump. And basically, the article is a recitation of why the president has committed the high crime and misdemeanor of incitement to insurrection. It's short. The version I have is about 4 pages long. It's pretty streamlined. It makes reference to a violation of the president's constitutional oath, faithfully to execute the office of president of the United States, which the article alleges he breached in part because he insisted over and over and over again on a bed of lies. This provides context that he won the election when he did not. And he fed to folks who were his supporters this lie that he won the election and did it in a context in which it was foreseeable that there would be, quote, lawless action at the Capitol, such as, quote, if you don't fight like hell, you're not going to have a country anymore, end quote. And it also includes that call that we talked about between the president and the secretary of state in Georgia, where he's basically threatening and pressuring a local state official to overturn the results of an election by asking for, you know, 11,000 some odd votes. And all of that together that culminated in the violent insurrection on the 6th, the Democrats who introduced this say, Nancy Pelosi says, is a good foundation for impeachment. Do you agree?
Yes, it's an astonishing thing that the president of the United States is about to be impeached for inciting violence. And if we had turned time back a year ago, I think we would have said we thought he was a danger to our country. I don't think I would have actually said out loud that I thought he would incite violence. And by the way, we should talk about this as we talk about the law enforcement response too, that I think most people didn't see this as a possibility. And that's a failure.
Can I say one funny thing?
Please.
It's not a lot of humor here, but I don't know if you saw that that viral video put out by Arnold Schwarzenegger where he talks about—
I did. I thought it was
excellent.
Really,
it was
important.
Very moving.
Yes.
And he talks about his background growing up in Austria and understanding that bad things can happen. There can be enablers.
President Trump sought to overturn the results of an election. He sought a coup by misleading people with lies. My father and our neighbors were misled also with lies. And I know where such lies lead.
And it was all very moving and very profound. And I saw someone make the point, if you could go back in time to 1985 and say to the world, there will come a day in the future when Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger calls out President Donald Trump for inciting an armed insurrection against the Capitol, you would be committed.
Yeah, you would not have seen that coming, for sure.
You would not have seen that coming.
I highly recommend that video, though. I thought it was very powerful. So back to the impeachment. So it's very straightforward. And remember that Congress can impeach, the House of Representatives can impeach the president for high crimes or misdemeanors. And that's basically, and also
whatever
of course
they
for
say
bribery,
it is.
Right.
Whatever
but basically, this is under the high crimes and misdemeanors. And you're right. It's whatever they say it is. So they've talked about that. They also, though, talk about Section 3 of the 14th Amendment to the Constitution. And it's worth just stopping on this for a second, where they say further, Section 3 of the 14th Amendment to the Constitution prohibits any person who has, quote, engaged in insurrection or rebellion against, close quote, the United States from, quote, holding any office under the United States. And so they're basically alleging the president incited violence and that it's both a high crime and misdemeanor, and it also violates Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. And that's something that we haven't talked about before. The other thing I think is really interesting about the article of impeachment is that, again, it's pretty streamlined, but it does include the president's conduct before January 6th and after January 6th and sort of on January 6th, which is important because it's all those calls that the president made. It's all the efforts the president made to tell people that it was a fraudulent election, that there was widespread fraud, that were not based with any evidence or support. Then the rally speech he gave on January 6th. And also, of course, the call he made on January 2nd to the Georgia Secretary of State. So they're bringing in more than just the rally speech, which I think is really, really important because they have to show that this was a pattern and that the president's goal in all of the work he did was to basically steal the election and to not have it lawfully certified.
We should talk about procedure for a second and just remind folks of how this works. So to impeach means to pass this article of impeachment. That just requires a majority vote in the House, which I think will certainly happen. I think as of the time we're recording this on Tuesday morning, there were at least 211 sponsors. All you need is 218 votes because you have 435 members in the House. And there's some possibility there will be Republicans. Adam Kinzinger, I think, is somebody who has suggested he might go along. Dick Cheney's daughter, Representative Cheney, also, I think, has left open the possibility of voting in favor of the article of impeachment. So you would have, for the first time, a bipartisan vote for impeachment. Now, once that happens, and this gets complicated, particularly given the timing, it moves to the Senate. And then there are two things that may happen. It is not that once impeachment has passed, nothing happens to the president. He doesn't get removed. There has to be conviction in the Senate. And as I remember from last time around this time, last year actually, there has to be a two-thirds majority in the Senate to convict. And then once conviction happens, the president is turned out of office. Now, given the timing, I think there's almost no way possible, not almost no way, there's no way possible that there will be a conviction in the Senate, even if you got all the votes you needed, in time to turn the president out of office. And so then a question that keeps nagging at people and that we keep getting asked is, well, aren't you then done once the president is gone? And the answer to that, I think the majority of experts on that question say, no, you're not done. You can continue with the trial even when the president has left office, because there's something else that's being sought in the article of impeachment, and that is disqualification from holding office again in the future. And I think the argument goes, the legal and constitutional argument goes, there'd be no reason to have that in the Constitution if it were the case that you couldn't have that vote once the president or some other official was out of office who had been impeached. Because upon conviction, you're out of office, and then the vote on disqualification would be moot. And so there have been precedents before, not with respect to the president, but with other officers of the United States, where they impeach by majority vote, they convict by two-thirds majority in the Senate, and then they have a separate disqualification vote, which people believe can just be by a majority vote, that says you can't come back to office again. And that's, I think, the thing that is important here, that people feel that the President of the United States, given his lack of patriotism and his offenses against the United States in connection with the armed insurrection, should never be able to hold office again. And that's, I think, the way it will unfold. There may be some arguments about whether or not the trial can go later. And then last point, and I'll throw it back to you. You know, there's a political question here of what Joe Biden wants. He's going to have to confirm his cabinet. He wants to deal with COVID relief in his first 100 days. And if at the same time we're having a big trial in the Senate, how is that going to work? I'm just glad I'm not the guy who has to make that decision.
And Biden has said, and I think this is the correct answer, that Congress is going to have to decide, that this is a critical, I understand and am very sympathetic to all the challenges here, and I think there are a lot of challenges. I also think that this is a moment in history. This is a national crisis. And so as important as I think it is for President-elect Biden to get his cabinet in place, I don't think that that should be the deciding factor in whether or not Congress moves forward.
They can do both, you think, right?
They can do both. Right. And I think, look, a lot of people have made this point that, you know, we're going to ask you to walk and chew gum at the same time. And there are times in the world where it's really important to do so. And this is one of them. A few just points on sort of where we are. The first is that the Senate is not coming back in session until January 19th. And so they could unanimously consent to come back earlier. They will not do that. And so
there's another way they can come back, actually. And Senator Schumer, I think, is thinking about invoking this. There is a power under which the majority leader and the minority leader themselves can bring the Senate back into emergency session, I believe. And there's the two of them have to show up and they could hammer something out. But McConnell would have to agree to that. And right. I don't think he will.
I don't think he will either. So there are some opportunities for it to go earlier, but just so folks understand, the likelihood is that the Senate will not get the message from the House that it has appointed impeachment managers and has impeached the president, and the Senate is in a position to receive that until January 19th, which really doesn't get the process going until January 20th or 21st. And of course, at that point, Joe Biden is president. We believe that Senator Schumer will be the majority leader. The Democrats will have taken the Senate at that moment in time. And so you really are talking about this isn't going to move right away. there's also precedent for impeaching a federal official after they leave office. Not the president of the United States. It hasn't been done with the president, but it was done with the war secretary in the administration of President Ulysses Grant. It was an individual, William Belknap, who resigned as he was about to be impeached for political corruption, basically taking money over $20,000, which back then in 1876 was a lot of money. And he resigned just minutes before the vote on impeachment was held. He was impeached. He then was tried. Basically, a month later, a majority voted against Belknap. But again, remember that it takes 2/3 to actually have somebody removed after conviction for impeachment. And so he was not convicted. He was not removed. And so, you know, but there is precedent. And I think it's fairly strong that President Trump can be tried after he leaves office.
Yeah. And I think common sense, too, because if it could be the case that the moment you're worried about impeachment or you are impeached or even you're convicted, you run for the hills, it would make moot this language in the Constitution that says you can disqualify a person from holding office in the future, because you can't hold the disqualification vote until you've done those other two steps in the process either. So, you know, the other reason we know that even if they could start before the 19th, that it's not going to get done in the Senate is it takes time to have a proceeding. And last time around, there was an interesting debate about witnesses and what kind of witnesses you would have. You know, I haven't fully wrapped my head around what kind of trial this would be if they had the luxury of some time. Like, who are the witnesses to call? Do you do it in a lengthy way? Do you sort of, for context, bring in all of the president's prior acts? Do you try to have people around him testify? Because some things that are relevant to all this, obviously, are statements the president made, his state of mind, the fact that I find this to be a powerful piece of evidence against the president, if it's confirmed from the after the reporting. So he says these things. He says you got to fight. He says, you know, go to the Capitol. He bases all this on the lie that he won the election, which he did not. And then according to news reports, when he's on TV watching the violence happening, watching people storm the Capitol, rather than be horrified, rather than say, oh my gosh, I never intended this, rather than say, this is a terrible thing, I need to call it off, he appears to be delighted and buoyed by this because these are his people fighting for him. And as you pointed out earlier, basically had to be pushed to put out some anodyne statement about how, you know, it's time to go home. The fact that he was somewhat joyed and joyous to see this violence taking place tells you something about his state of mind when he was egging them on in the first place. And so I don't know, you know, who the witnesses are, who would get that in.
Well, let's go back also to the Ukrainian impeachment, because I think that there's a model that we've seen, but it does extend the time, which is for Congress and the Judiciary Committee and the House to hold hearings. And in my view, as a former prosecutor, and I'd be curious to know if you differ on this, but it's been publicly reported from individuals who were in the White House with the president the day of the riots, exactly what you just said, that he was almost gleeful watching the Capitol be ransacked. And it's one thing to basically call a reporter off the record or to leak that off the record. It is another thing to say that publicly. And it really, to me, is not enough to just put in a media story saying it was reported X, right? And so they need a witness. And that means that they need people who have surrounded Trump and who are going to be very conflicted, I think, about what their role should be in the impeachment, particularly after the president has left office. And we should talk a little bit about what I think are serious and really unacceptable efforts by Republicans to minimize the harm that can be done by the president long term. And sort of they keep saying, well, let's just get, you know, as long as we can get through the next 8 days, everything will be fine. Everything will not be fine, in my view, without accountability and a reckoning of what has happened. And so I think that to get those individuals who were surrounding the president that day, to get that kind of evidence in the record, you will need the House Judiciary Committee to subpoena witnesses. That takes longer. And the way they would have to do it, I don't think that they have a lot of time on this. They would have to do it really tight. They would have to have their witness list. They would have to basically go in and try to just get this out as quickly and done as quickly as possible to get that to the Senate. It's complicated. And so
I don't think they're going to do that.
I don't think they're going to do it.
They're going to vote on the article immediately without hearings.
And then it's going to go, right. And so that means they have to rely on the public record and the president's Twitter feed.
But there's also a possibility of getting witnesses. Just because they didn't appear in the House, you can have witnesses come in the Senate.
You could have them testify at impeachment. That's right. Yes. So they can have witnesses in the Senate. Remember, there was a big fight during the Ukrainian impeachment about whether or not they would call witnesses, with not a sufficient number of senators voting to hear many of those witnesses. And we may be in the same position here, but there is a way.
But the difference is that Chuck Schumer will be the majority leader.
Yes.
And he will have a view on witnesses that's different from Mitch McConnell, potentially. Although, by the way, Mitch McConnell and Donald Trump are on the outs. And there's reporting that says Mitch McConnell will never speak to Donald Trump again. And of course, Mitch McConnell's wife, Elaine Chao, who's the Secretary of Transportation, resigned a few days before. So I don't know what the state of mind of Mitch McConnell is. I also think it's the case, as you mentioned, you know, these other witnesses, people who are around the president, how will they feel about being called to testify? You know, once the president is gone, and given the change of feelings that I think a lot of them have had, given the resignations and everything else, and the feeling of shock and anger, I think there's a greater chance that some of these people will come forward and testify against Donald Trump because he will no longer be the commander in chief. And they've seen things firsthand and up close that should be mortifying to them. So I'm a little bit more optimistic that some of those people will come forward.
I'm hopeful you're right. And I also think that this just hits home closer than the telephone call to the Ukrainian president. It's different than what we saw in January.
Yeah, because it happened before our very eyes, and there's video. I mean, video is very compelling.
And there's violence, and there's a Capitol Police officer who died at the hands of the insurrectionist mob. And so I do think, yes, I think it's a different situation. I personally think that the Senate is going to have to do both. They're going to have to work to confirm Biden's nominees. They're going to have to get, there's just huge issues before the United States government with COVID. And so they're going to have to do that work at the same time as they do this. But I personally, I don't know how you feel about it, but I do favor impeachment. And I think it's an important moment to basically have accountability and to have there be a reckoning and a conversation about what's happened. And I think if we don't, you know, the argument that's been given, I wonder what you think of this, Preet, the argument that's been given by a number of the sort of House Republicans and others is you're just going to like upset Trump supporters more, right? Like if you want
and
there
divide
to be,
the country.
Yes, so if now you want there to be, now, exactly.
Now it's the responsibility of Joe Biden, by the way, who has been preaching unity, who has been talking about moving away from division, who, by the way, was the victim of the high crime and misdemeanor that was the subject of the first impeachment, is also the victim of, in a way, of this misconduct that's the basis of the second impeachment, right? What Trump has been trying
to do
is
destroy. He's the intended victim, yes.
He's the intended victim of all this stuff. And he, by the way, has been saying, at some political cost to himself with people on the left, I want to move on. I don't want to be divisive. Maybe it's not the best thing to do. And even then, the chutzpah of some of these Trump supporters saying, well, you know, Joe Biden is making it worse by not saying let's move on and not calling House and Senate Democrats, who, by the way, their lives were at risk from this insurrection, and Joe Biden is the bad guy for not telling them to stand down. It's almost too much to take.
Yeah, you don't get to light the flame and then say that, scream, the building's on fire.
Yeah.
And yeah, they've started.
Especially if it's in a theater.
Yes. right. Which brings us back to the president of the United States. And can he be charged with inciting violence? Because as we know from prior Cafe Insiders, it's not protected speech if you stand up in a crowded movie theater and scream fire. And so this brings us right back to this conversation about the president, Preet.
So people don't love it when I say this kind of thing. As I look at it, and it depends on what other evidence comes to light and what people say the president's motivation was, what his intention was, what he said to people, he and others are sometimes a little bit smart. That includes Josh Hawley and Ted Cruz. They didn't get up and say, which would make it a clearer case, they didn't say, I want you to march on the Capitol, and I want you to break in, and I want you to break the windows, and I want you to take hostages, and I want you to be, you know, armed when you do. They didn't say all those things. There is a, I think, plausible argument that all that violence was foreseeable, and the things that he did say about fight and what Giuliani said about trial by combat and the state of mind that the president had when he was joyously watching the violence taking place, that's all evidentiary support in favor of convicting him on one of these very, very serious statutes. But there's also a countervailing legal principle of free speech that is accorded to the president and others as well. And it's a tricky boundary, right? There's a case from some decades ago called Brandenburg that makes it seem difficult to convict a person who is not so explicit and was not directly and personally involved in the violence. It makes it difficult to convict that person on such a statute.
So I don't think it's a simple legal question. I agree with you on that, but I feel very strongly that there needs to be an investigation of this. And
100%.
And one of the concerns I had was when sort of last week the DC US attorney said none of the speakers at the rally are going to be, you know, investigated and charged, and that felt wrong to me and just premature for the following reason. The president has a significant amount of conduct, which you just went through, that also predates January 6th. And so there is a lot that we don't know about how this movement was organized. This was a movement, and this was a coordinated movement. And you saw the man who was wearing the sort of silly outfit has been charged with a federal crime. One of the things he stated when interviewed by the FBI was the president requested that we be there. And so I think we need to understand a lot more of what was happening on social media. What were the efforts undertaken by the Trump team with this sort of Stop the Steal branding campaign that they were bringing nationally? And I think we have to understand the president did say, go to the Capitol. Now, he didn't say storm the Capitol, but I think it is required that there be a deeper investigation before a conclusion is brought on this. And it may be, I agree, it's hard to charge. It may be that it's not the correct thing to charge. And that's a reasonable conclusion, potentially at the end of an investigation after you've seen all the facts and evidence. It just felt really wrong to me. And look, also, there's a common sense moment of the president stood in the Ellipse and basically said, they're stealing the election from us. This election is fraud. I won by a landslide. Go to the Capitol. I mean, there's sort of a common sense moment of whether or not the president is criminally liable for it. In my view, he is liable as the head of the party. And the individual who called on people to come to Washington for January 6th, he called for the senators and the members of the House to object to the certification. So he is responsible. The question of whether or not he has criminal liability, I think, is a question for investigators and a more thorough review of the evidence.
Also, there's multiple things we're looking at here. We're not just talking about incitement and sedition. A lot of the things he did would relate to interference in an election. And it also would bring into, I think, the equation, the call with the Secretary of State in Georgia. And I think that should be looked at. There's this weird and I think dishonorable thing that happened in the last week where the U.S. attorney in Atlanta, according to reports, was forced to resign because the president was unhappy with his voter fraud efforts, you know, continues to be this bugaboo for Republicans, this false holy grail that they keep seeking. But I think there's a lot of questions to be asked about who else the president was in touch with. What senators was he calling?
What secretaries of states he was calling?
In other states as well. I mean, it seems like there was a very broad-based campaign led by the president himself and participated in directly by the president himself. He is the one who got on the phone with these people to try to interfere with not just the broad overall election, but individual elections in states. And that in conjunction with his role in the riot, I 100% agree with you, merits deep investigation.
Also on the Georgia, on the move, and we haven't really covered this because there's been so much happening, but the president forced out the Atlanta U.S. attorney, who, by the way, was a Trump loyalist. And we should say that he just wasn't loyal enough and he wasn't willing to bring these election fraud cases. And what the president did in that instance was, and again, we talked about this when it came to the firing of Jeffrey Berman in the Southern District. The president wanted to bring in the individual who he thought was more loyal, the New Jersey U.S. attorney, Craig Carpenito. He wanted Carpenito to move into the Southern District U.S. attorney instead of promoting Audrey Strauss, who was the first assistant and the second in command in the office. And because this was publicly reported, that was not allowed to happen. It did happen in Georgia. Instead of promoting the first assistant to be the U.S. attorney in Georgia, they took the U.S. attorney from the Southern District of Georgia and put him in. And we can only assume that that was done because he's an extreme loyalist and maybe willing to bring false election fraud cases. And so there is a consistent effort to undercut the rule of law. And it's been, the president has done it in the media. He's tried to do it in the courts, but he's been rebuffed. He's tried to do it in the state election with the election officials. He's been rebuffed. But we don't, I think, have a full accounting of all those efforts yet. And again, I think there's, whether or not there's a charge brought, I really do come back to whether it's a 9/11 style commission, there has to be a full and thorough accounting for what has happened with the president and the election, his efforts to basically invalidate the election incorrectly, to basically lie and cheat and ultimately steal the election. There has to be a conversation about what he did, what worked, what didn't work. And, you know, I talked about it at the beginning, but there's a really compelling piece by Fiona Hill in Politico talking about this was an attempted self-coup by the president, but in order to have been successful, he would have needed the courts to have gone in his favor. The media has, you know, we'll talk about Twitter in a minute, but the media has now stepped back from him. He sort of generated his own media to a certain extent. He does have loyalists, but at the end of the day, you know, the election officials stood firm. And so there are a lot of examples of ways in which I think our constitutional structure has held strong, but there's also a way in which, like, we have to have a real conversation about what is happening and how do we prevent future harm.
Yeah. And by the way, those things are not mutually exclusive. You can have an impeachment proceeding. You can have a Senate trial on that. You can have DOJ investigating. You can have local prosecutors investigating. And you can also have a sort of 9/11 style commission to figure out how to avoid this kind of thing happening again in the future. So all of those things can happen. Before we talk about what should happen to the actual participants in the violence, the rioters, and their fate and the charges brought against them, I think just very quickly, and we can talk more about this in future weeks, there is, you know, discussion about using Section 3 of the 14th Amendment to expel people like Senator Josh Hawley and Ted Cruz, and there's a member of the House. It's unclear how that mechanism works, and there's some dispute in legal circles about whether or not there needs to be enough evidence to prove under the insurrection statute that someone has been found guilty of, you know, inciting an insurrection, or if the standard is more like impeachment, where members of Congress can decide on their own if those standards have been met. So I don't know what's going to happen. What I do know is there's a lot of blowback against Josh Hawley and Ted Cruz and some others, and I think deservedly so.
Yeah, I think Mo Brooks, the congressman, and Louie Gohmert, there's a lot of blowback against them, and also rightfully so. And I think that there has to be a reckoning or a conversation about accountability and what it looks like for them. I think we'll have time to talk about what should happen. I will note that what's been fascinating to watch about Hawley is that his book publisher is not willing to publish his book. His former mentor, John Danforth, the Missouri senator, has basically said, it's the worst mistake of my career that I supported him. And so he is starting to feel the repercussions of this. But he also, it turns out, was not truthful when he said that an Antifa mob had attacked his house and basically vandalized his house. It turns out that's not true. And so there are just huge, huge questions that I think need to be answered. And there'll be a lot of time to talk about what that looks like and whether Congress holds these individuals responsible. You know, I think you can, you know, can you have a recall election? Could the people in their communities have conversations? There might be a number of options for people to consider. But I do think it should be a point of conversation for the leaders of this effort. I'd also say one other thing I don't know if you've noticed, and we should talk about this more down the road, but we've seen companies now, and there's a reckoning that needs to take place internal in these businesses as well, but they are now stepping forward, and some of them are saying, we will not give money to any individual who voted to not certify the electors. And that's 140 plus members of Congress. And that's going to take a big hit, including, I think, Rick Scott, who now chairs, I think, the Senate campaign committee. And that's the individual. He's supposed to raise a lot of money. He voted against certifying the electors. And a number of folks are saying they will not contribute any money to him. And so there's a real life hammer that's coming down on these folks. I'm not saying that that's sufficient, but I think it's really important.
Yeah, I would note the irony. If it turns out that Donald Trump's and others' involvement in insurrection and trying to illegally overturn the election is the cause of getting big corporate money out of politics, we could sort of thank them for that. So, you know, we had thousands of people descend upon the Capitol. We should talk before we go about what should happen to them, what is happening with them. And as I think it's worth pointing out again, astonishingly, how gently many of them were treated. If it was, you know, 2,000 black people or 2,000 Muslims or people who look like me who were literally breaking into the Capitol, I think we'd have seen a lot more death, a lot more death. And that has people angry as well because it looks like a double standard. And as we said at the outset, there are some Capitol police officers who look like they were in cahoots. There's investigations going on with respect to a number of them, we're told through news reports. And not a lot of arrests happened that day. And people will point that again, comparing it to the protests after George Floyd was killed. You had hundreds and hundreds of arrests in connection with protests, many of which were largely peaceful. And here you have the FBI and other authorities sort of fanning out throughout the entire lower 48 to try to find people based on social media postings and tips from neighbors and others, rather than have them be arrested at the scene. So it's very upsetting to people to see two standards of justice here. And as the arrests and charges come pouring in, some of them are, you know, fairly low-level offenses of entering federal buildings when they're not supposed to. We have not seen any murder charges yet. What do you make of the level of charging that's happened? And what do you think will become of the other folks who haven't yet been charged?
The first point we should talk about, and I want to be very clear on the law enforcement question. We have seen there are investigations. I think there are 10 or 12 Capitol officers who are being investigated for working with the rioters, the extremists who entered the Capitol. There are also individuals in other police departments across the country who were off duty and who were present. And some of those individuals were present. It's been reported inside the Capitol. And this is, it's so troubling to me. I mean, there's a BuzzFeed story, an African-American Capitol police officer. I think this is a really moving article and we should attach a link to it where he talks about, you know, there were people walking by me carrying the sort of blue police flags and they were pushing police officers, right? And they were trying to essentially, you know, and they were saying, we're with you. Well, you're not with them. You're not with the Capitol police officers. And so any Capitol police officers who went along with the insurrection or stood down when they should have stood up, they need to be held to account and disciplined. But I do also want to note, there are a number of heroic Capitol police officers. And we've seen some of those videos where the officers, they put themselves in harm's way. So there were a lot of law enforcement officers who really did an outstanding job that day. And moreover, one of the reasons why people were allowed to leave is that they were so deeply and woefully underprepared for this. And you are right to talk about there are two standards of justice. When you look at the response to the Black Lives Matter protests, a lot of which was led by the federal government that had brought in thousands of National Guards members, here they made a mistake. What the federal government did in the June Black Lives Matter protest was absolutely wrong. It was sort of a very sort of, I don't want to say spur of the moment protest, but it was not planned. It wasn't being talked about on social media. There were no hashtags that said storm the Capitol. No one was talking about taking members of Congress hostage. The president of the United States was not talking about the election having been stolen from him and being fraudulent. So the circumstances are entirely different.
And no hanging nobody said hang Mike Pence.
Exactly. And so in June, when this happened, the federal government was heavily involved. Bill Barr ran the command center. Remember the members of the defense, the sort of Mark Esper was there, Mark Milley was there, the sort of chiefs of DOD. And I think there was a huge reaction to that. The mayor of DC, the Capitol Police, the Metropolitan Police in DC, they all didn't want to be accused of sort of this heavy show of force. And then they made the wrong decision here. And this merits a much longer conversation, but there was intelligence of what was happening. As Michael Chertoff, the former head of Homeland Security, said, you didn't need the intelligence, you just needed to read the newspapers. I mean, it was kind of that obvious, but for people like the FBI, like the Department of Homeland Security, who are on these online chat centers every day, they're following extremists, there was a lot of warning of what was going to happen, and they were underprepared for it. They were underprepared, and there was no command control structure. And that's why it devolves into, and they didn't imagine that the president of the United States was going to put out this call to sort of go to the Capitol. You put all that together, and they were scrambling to keep the members of Congress safe, which thankfully they did. And they were scrambling to try to get people under control in the Capitol, and they failed. They were not able to take control of the Capitol back until the Metropolitan Police Force sent a commander in who took charge, command and control. There were FBI teams who were there. The National Guard came like 4 hours later, and that's a whole nother conversation. But only at that point were they able to take control. And I suspect what we'll find out is that they did not have the capacity at that moment to make arrests, which they should have been able to do. They should have stopped people from going in, and they should have had the capacity to make the arrests. But it's sort of, it's like a snowball effect that the mistakes just compound on one another. And then you get to this point where you're letting all these people go. As to the charges, we're going to see more. I have no question in my mind that the FBI and other law enforcement agencies are aggressively looking at who was involved in the death of Officer Sicknick. I have no question but that anybody who engaged in violence against officers within the Capitol, they're looking at. I hope that they're also looking at the individuals who were coordinating these efforts and who were perhaps most responsible and for inciting violence. There also, you know, we talked about the Molotov cocktails and the assault weapons. There were pipe bombs that were put in front of the DNC and the RNC. We have yet to see arrests. You know, it hasn't been publicly reported that they've interviewed folks or arrested anyone related to those. So there should be a lot coming. And right now, I do know that it looks small, that a lot of the folks are charged with stealing property, with violently entering the building, with disorderly conduct, and the sort of statutes, the sentences are up to a year. I think the question of whether or not people should be charged with sedition, should be charged with, you know, solicitation to violence, all that requires deeper investigations. And I do think we're going to see additional charges. I would also note that just by way of comparison, there were over 300 arrests in the Black Lives Matter protest. And again, no one stormed the Capitol during that period of time. And there's something like, I think maybe there's like 70 or 80 arrests now. 50 of those are fairly low-level cases brought in DC Superior Court, and maybe, you know, 20 or so are more serious federal crimes. But we will see more, I think.
So, Am, you know, we're kind of running out of time here. We could go on for a long time about the charges and how things will play out in the Senate. Some other thing happened that has gotten a lot of people's attention and made people, some people, interestingly, more upset than the insurrection itself, and that is the permanent suspension, although some people say that's an oxymoron, the permanent suspension of Donald Trump from Twitter. That's been his big megaphone, even though he has other opportunities to use megaphones. And we haven't heard from, we don't know what he's thinking these days. And, you know, there's some controversy with respect to that. Twitter takes a position that in order to reduce the risk of further violence and rioting and insurrection, after repeated warnings, the President of the United States still continues to post things that are not true and that foment violence because they go to this lie that he keeps telling about the election and keeps trying to change the results of the election. So he's off Twitter, and a lot of people are applauding that. What do you think?
When people think about First Amendment and free speech, it really is. It's the First Amendment to the Constitution is basically talking about Congress can pass no law. It's talking about the government and what the government can and can't do. Twitter is a private company.
Is Twitter in the Constitution?
It is not in the Constitution, and it is not in the government. It is not. And so I think there's been a lot of commentary out there that I think is just wrong. And I understand why people are concerned about freedom of speech. And that's a really important, it's one of the things that America is built on, that we openly disagree with one another and that there aren't repercussions. That being said, Twitter, like many other social media companies, when you get an account, you agree to the terms of service. And Twitter, in their terms of service, very explicitly prohibits essentially inciting violence. And so basically, they've been warning the president repeatedly, don't do this. They've been labeling his tweets as inaccurate. And I think they were able to have this illusion that it was just words, and it wasn't really an incitement to violence until last Wednesday, when it became very clear that there was violence and that there were armed individuals who were showing up at the Capitol and that they felt that they were responding directly to the president. And it's not just Twitter, Amazon Web Services, they host websites. They've taken Parler, which has become really a hotbed for the pro-Trump extremists. Amazon has now taken them off Amazon Web Services. And it's basically private companies saying, you're violating our terms of service. We're not comfortable having people incite violence. And so, which they're entitled to do. So I think it's worth the conversation about, you know, we don't want to be regulating speech we disagree with, but there's a line, and that line is clear in the law. It's also very clear in the terms of service. And private companies, you don't get to tell a private company what their terms of service are.
Yeah. So two final points from me, one in favor of Twitter and one against. And you touched on it a second ago. The people who are complaining about this decision by Twitter have it exactly backwards. The threat to freedom is not that a private company has chosen not to carry the messages of the head of government. The threat to freedom comes when you force a private company to air the views and statements, false or not, of the head of government.
Right. That's such a great point. That's such a great point. In China,
that's where the threat. People say this is like China. It's not like China.
In China, whatever the sort of social media, Weibo or whatever it is, like their equivalent of this, they could never have the president of China not be on it. Like, it essentially run by the government, by the state, right? It's right. There's a lot of control.
It's like these capitalists like Josh Hawley and others who cry censorship, they don't really understand. I mean, I think they do understand. They're smart people. But, you know, it's a nice flag to wave on Fox News and elsewhere and say, free speech, free speech, free speech, because that slogan is so ingrained in us. But then I will say, point against Twitter. I'm not of the view that government should decide what Twitter's rules are or not. But I do think that it's not great that there is a, you know, opaque policy by which, you know, huge companies, social media platforms like Twitter and others decide who gets to be on, who gets to be off. They have that right. That's another interesting thing, right? You know, it used to be the case that if someone has the power to do something, the Trumpists say, well, that ends the argument. They have the power to do it, it's fine. Well, Twitter has the power to do this. And I've always said it doesn't necessarily make it fine. But for good citizenship and good corporate practices, and I think for good business also, I think you'd like to see these social media companies come up with a more transparent process.
I agree very strongly with that.
A quasi-independent committee that sets the rules and the standards. And it is a legitimate question to ask, why is Trump, you know, off Twitter, but you have leaders of other countries who've engaged in despotism who are still on Twitter? And maybe there are good reasons for that. You know, Angela Merkel has decried the Twitter decision. Government should not be deciding, but I would urge these companies to figure out a way to do it that is open and transparent and fair across all party distinctions.
I agree with that. I would also note that Twitter, they do sometimes take political individuals off Twitter. They just took one of the Uganda political figures off Twitter. And so this is neither the first time nor the last time that Twitter will do it. But the question is a fair question, which is, it is an enormous power, and it is enormous power that we're essentially entrusting tech entrepreneurs and you know, very successful business people to make. And there are rules and standards, but there should be a process, and that process should be more transparent, because there should be comfort that individuals are being treated equally and fairly when they're basically being evaluated under the existing standards. And I think that's a really reasonable and fair thing to say. I will also say this to you. I personally take all the moves by social media, and I do this also in light of the public statements that are made by members of Congress who were just briefed on the potential threats next week. I believe that they understand that there is deeper harm that is possible, and that we are not out of the woods on this insurrection and the potential for violence. And so I think it's easy for us to sit here now and sort of weigh these arguments, but I also want to be fair to them, sitting as companies having just watched something horrific happen and not wanting to be the sort of conduit for more of that in the coming week.
An extreme thing happened. An extreme thing happened in the United States of America. And it was fed by people at the top of U.S. government. And so it stands to reason that some of the reactions are going to be pretty extraordinary, to use your word. We'll be back in a week, one day before the swearing in of Joe Biden. Luckily, Ann and
I
are still on Twitter.
Last question, Preet. Is Donald Trump going to self-pardon before we come back?
Yeah, I think he will. And we'll be able to talk about that. I don't know how effective that'll be, but you know, my view has always been, if I had a dollar to bet, I would bet that he would. Because I don't think he has any boundaries at all. So luckily, we're still on Twitter, so you can tweet at us. Or if you have questions, you can send them to us at letters@cafe.com.
And we'll do our best to answer them. Thanks so much. Take care.
Thank you for listening. You can now try the Cafe Insider membership free for 2 weeks. To join, head to cafe.com/insider. That's cafe.com/insider. To all our insiders, thank you for supporting our work. That's it for this week's Cafe Insider podcast. Your hosts are Preet Bharara and Ann Milgram. The executive producer is Tamara Sepper. The senior producer is Adam Waller. The technical director is David Tatasciore. And the Cafe team is Matthew Billy, David Curlander, Sam Ozer-Staten, Noah Azulai, Nat Wiener, Jake Kaplan, Calvin Lord, Jeff Eisenman, Chris Boylan, Sean Walsh, and Margot Maley. Our music is by Andrew Dost. Thank you for being a part of the Cafe Insider community.